Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Eade, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have one case on our calendar today, October 3rd, 2023, rescheduled from an earlier date. I hope everyone is well. Looks like it.
Yes.
The case that we have today is A221721, Dixon versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Marshall will show a running clock of your time. You should see that on your screen. Please pay attention to your time. I'd ask that you state your name and your client's name before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. That's the only recording that's permitted. And with that, counsel, anytime you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Charles Klippert appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Gerald Willie Dixon. And Mr. Dixon was convicted of a fourth degree assault out of Scott County. And I think it's clear in the pleadings that Mr. Dixon was using a lot of court time because he had a number of cases that were going through Scott County. The conviction in this case was an altercation with a guard when Mr. Dixon refused to go back into his cell. Mr. Dixon represented himself throughout the proceedings, and the issue here before the court is whether there was a valid waiver of his right to an attorney on the record. And there isn't. There was no waiver pursuant to Rule 504 on the record. And I think the state's position is that Mr. Dixon's familiarity with the court and experience with the court, it's a sufficient basis for a waiver. And we're fortunate because we now have before us a non-precedential opinion from the same county involving the same defendant with the same issue in State v. Gerald Dixon that was decided on May 22nd, 2023. And we have essentially the same facts. We have the same law. Nothing has changed. And in that case, this court found that there was not a valid waiver. And I think there would have to be a pretty significant reason for this court to vary from this prior. Again, it's non-precedential, but if there's got to be some something materially different between the facts in that case and here to warrant a different decision. I think it would cause some pretty significant confusion if this court were to decide this issue a different way. But I think it's really important, a couple of things here, that there is no express waiver on the record. There's no indication that Mr. Dixon would not have signed the waiver form. And throughout the whole proceedings, there's Mr. Dixon invokes his right to proceed pro se, but no one ever completes the deal by going through the waiver and 504. He says, I want to represent myself, but no one pumps the brakes and says, okay, let's talk about the charges. Let's talk about the consequences. Let's talk about your rights. Are there defenses? Are there mitigation? So there's just nothing in the record to show that that was ever done on Mr. Dixon's behalf. So unless this court has questions, I think following the guidance from the May 22nd, 2023, I'll just call it Dixon 1. I think this court needs to reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
I have a question for. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I have a question for you, Mr. Klippert. You argue in your brief, similar to as you just said, that essentially, Mr. Dixon didn't receive any of the information that would normally be provided to someone in waiving their right to counsel. As I understand the state's argument, they essentially are asking the court to look at other similar cases in which Mr. Dixon had an attorney immediately prior to the proceedings that led to this appeal. So I'm wondering, what are the limits in your view of what you're asking us to do here? In other words, if someone appeared one day with an attorney on a fourth degree assault of a corrections officer, and they discharged their lawyer, they had talked about the matter fully with that person, and then they go back to the jail and they pick up another fourth degree and they come back the next day and they say, no, I don't want a lawyer. Could we rely on the fact that the defendant had received every sort of piece of information that otherwise would have been provided as part of a valid waiver in the previous case and looking at that second case?
Yeah, Judge, that's a good point. Because I think if the first waiver had been a full-throated Rule 504 compliant waiver, and I think if the judge said, you know, Mr. Dixon, here you were here yesterday, we reviewed these rights, do you have any question about those rights? I mean, it happens all the time in district court with plea petitions. You know, someone will come in with three different files and you'll go through a very thorough waiver on the first file. But on the second and the third, you may say, you know, we've discussed these rights in the file ending 1, 2, 3. You understand those rights. The same rights apply here. So that certainly could be a basis, but the record is really thin on when and if there was a full-throated Rule 504 waiver. And I get real concerned if the waiver is occurring before, like, even the offense date. And I think that gets to be a real problem about saying, well, there was a waiver on a misdemeanor domestic. Is that good enough for a waiver on a felony assault? Or I wouldn't think it would be because of the difference in the penalties. But or if the law changes in between the waiver and the trial. So I wouldn't work too hard to find an exception, because I think the exception has become fraught, and I think it would be better to follow the rule. I don't know if that answers the question, but.
Well, and I mean, that's not really our situation. Like you said, the record's not clear that even in other cases, there was a 504 waiver, but the idea that someone had counsel, as you discuss in your brief and the state discusses, for a period of time on a similar charge, it seems like the state's suggesting that that should be enough. And so I'm wondering if it was a situation where for a period of months, this is a different hypothetical, that the defendant had the benefit of an attorney representing him for a period of months on a fourth degree assault. They discharge that lawyer that night. They pick up a new fourth degree assault. They come back the next day. They say, I don't want any attorney. Would you, in that situation, agree that, you know, the same charge, same criminal history now applies to the defendant? Would you agree that the court could rely on the prior representation and advice in deciding that the waiver without going through 504 was sufficient?
Well, that's one step removed from Worthy, because, you know, Worthy, he had lawyers all the way up until trial and then tried to fire that lawyer. And Worthy, it seemed to be more of a trial delay tactic than anything else. I think if there were a thorough record referencing, again, something to the effect of, you know, Mr. Client, you had a lawyer, you know, for 3 months on these charges, he's advised you of the again, if there were a thorough record on that, yes. But I think on the record here before the court, no. So again, back, you know, if it was a fourth degree assault, you know, and the record was, you know, Mr. Smith, you had a lawyer, the lawyer, you know, reviewed with you the consequences, you understand the charges, things like that, kind of getting closer to the 504 waiver. Yes, but I think if you're just saying that someone comes in the next day and says, I'm here on a new charge and I want to represent myself, and there's no further waiver, I think that would be insufficient.
Thank you.
Anything else from the panel?
Mr. Clifford, it doesn't appear from the record that no matter how many warnings or forms that Mr. Dixon signed that he would have wanted an attorney. And he seemed pretty adamant about representing himself.
Sure. And he may be dead set to have represented himself, but you'd still got to be a knowing and intelligent waiver. So again, someone needed to pump the brakes and make sure that that waiver was completed before he represented himself. And it's fine. Yeah, obviously he has an absolute right to represent himself, but it's got to be a knowing and intelligent waiver.
He represented himself on the prior files, though, and had standby counsel on those, correct?
Correct.
And he had standby counsel in this case?
Yes. And I can tell the court I've been standby counsel. And I don't know what his standby counsel's role was, but I actually was very, I kept an arm's length about representation because in my view, the client had already made the decision to represent himself. And then my role was to act as standby counsel. And it sounds like here, standby counsel filed motions, maybe had more of a support role than an actual attorney. But I think the role of standby counsel is very different than a trial attorney.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Mr. Clippert, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
Mr. Zettler, we're going to reset the clock, and then you may proceed. Go ahead, anytime.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent Respondent, the state of Minnesota. I recognize I have a bit of a hole to dig out of in light of Dixon 1 and Dixon 2, which was what I refer to as the first two appeals, which were decided against the state. I was not able to convince the court there. I hope that I'm able to convince the court here. He never signed a Rule 5 waiver. That's clear. The question then becomes whether his waiver was knowingly and intelligently made in light of the totality, essentially the totality of the facts and circumstances. So why should this case be any different than Dixon 1 and 2? First, the motion to suppress should be denied in this case. We have slightly different facts. The question that this court had in Dixon 1 and 2.
What motion to suppress? You mean the motion to strike?
I'm sorry, yes, the motion to strike.
Why should we deny the motion to strike when it's the same circumstances in Dixon 1? You're giving us information that's not in the record. And how are we to ascertain the veracity of that information?
So the question in Dixon 1 and 2 was what happened in that first file? Because there's nothing in the record at that time. Now there is. Now we have the transcript. Now we know that he actually made the court appearance, that he was actually appointed a public defender to advise him about counsel, being appointed counsel. And we have an express dismissal of counsel by Dixon. That was the question that this court had in Dixon 1 and 2, one of the questions, and that's now answered. So if this court were to look at that and find that compelling, then this court has the ability, where the orderly administration of justice commends it, to look at that evidence because it is a district court record. This court can reach that.
Can you point to me where in the record Mr. Dixon was advised, at least that we can see, of the potential consequences of a conviction in this action and what his responsibility would be in proceeding pro se? I just didn't see it, but if there's something in the record that I didn't see, I'd like you to point it to me.
As far as him knowing, Mr. Dixon knowing the consequences of a conviction?
I mean, you know, our recent precedential opinion, State versus Gantt, says that the defendant, when they're waiving counsel or waiving counsel by circumstances, has to do so with their eyes wide open, which means that they need to know what all of the components of the Rule 504 waiver are, either an express waiver or by implied waiver. So where in the record does it show that Mr. Dixon had his eyes wide open in proceeding pro se, knowing what all the consequences were of proceeding on his own behalf and also what the consequences of a conviction might be?
So he knew what the consequences of a conviction would be, because at the omnibus hearing, we discussed the consequences of a conviction. We discussed what the maximum sentence was. So he was well aware of that. In addition, he had just proceeded to trial in Dixon 1, been convicted and been sentenced. And he had been to trial in Dixon 2 and been convicted and sentenced. And so he ended up in this case with the exact same sentence that he received in Dixon 2. So he is, from the surrounding facts and circumstances, he was well aware of what the risks were of proceeding to trial pro se. In fact, he had just done it twice.
And he let me ask you about that, though, because that kind of goes back to your opposition to the motion to strike. So as I understood your response to Judge Frisch, you were pointing to three things: what was told to Mr. Dixon at the omnibus hearing, plus evidence outside our record, what had happened in these other files. And in your brief, you cite at least two cases about taking judicial notice of public records. The first is this Egan Economic Development Authority versus U-Haul Company of Minnesota, 787 Northwest 2nd 523. In that case, what was at issue was a local enabling law. It was a enabling resolution enacted by the Egan City Council. And so the Supreme Court said, that's a local law and a public record. We'll consider it in deciding the case. And Schroeder v. Simon just decided this year, the judicial notice was taken of the underlying convictions of the plaintiffs with regard to their lawsuit to restore their civil rights to vote. So do you have any cases in which this court or any other court has taken judicial notice of facts from other trials and other proceedings in trying to decide this issue? Since two of the places you're asking us to look for support that Mr. Dixon was appropriately advised was two separate proceedings.
Okay, I think that I do. Number one, and I'll give the court that. But also, I'm not asking the court necessarily to go outside of the record in looking at the prior convictions. I think the law is crystal clear. You can look at prior convictions. And in fact, the Supreme Court instructs that you should look at his criminal record when you are looking at whether it was knowingly and intelligently done in this case. And his criminal record now includes the conviction in Dixon 1 and includes the conviction in Dixon 2. So I don't think that that's going outside the record. However, in addition, in a number of cases, and frankly, there's quite a few cases where this court takes judicial notice of district court records. For instance, in State versus Christensen, this court took judicial notice of an HRO and denied Christian's motion to strike. And that's an unpublished opinion from this court in 2014, which I can give the cite to. In Haywood, there's a number of unpublished decisions where this court...
Mr. Zettler, what exactly do you want us to take judicial notice of? A whole file? Something that happened in district court? I mean, I think that sort of gets to what Judge Eade is asking you. We take judicial notice of facts, the existence of something that is not reasonably subject to dispute, the existence of an HRO, a court order, the existence of an ordinance, a law. What exactly are you asking us to take judicial notice of?
The transcript of the proceedings in file 4001, where he was expressly appointed a public defender to advise him about his right to counsel and his then dismissal of that counsel at the next hearing.
And you're filing that as part of the appeal. It wasn't filed in the district court action below.
The transcript of the proceeding?
The transcript of a proceeding in a different case that was not filed in the proceeding below, correct?
It was not filed in this case file. That's correct.
So then how is it part of our record on appeal?
The same way district court records would be part of this record in any other case were the court to want to take judicial notice of it. But I think that that's different than the second part of my argument, which is that you can look at his convictions, that you're expressly ordered to do so.
So when we're looking at some of these convictions, we've reversed a couple of them. So I don't know how we can look at convictions that are now subject to a retrial. Well, they're not convictions anymore.
When you're looking at the totality of the facts and circumstances as to whether his waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, I think you can look at the fact that he proceeded to trial twice and therefore knew what those consequences were twice.
Well, in the case that we sent back, we found that he did not, we concluded that he did not, he was not appropriately advised.
Correct.
Of his right. How can we take judicial notice of that conviction or recognize that? I just don't understand. I don't understand how this ball keeps rolling down the hill when we're sending it back.
Because when you're looking at the surrounding facts and circumstances, the fact that he proceeded to trial twice, knowing what the consequences of a conviction were, that's the question you're looking at, not whether...
But Mr. Zettler, isn't it more than that? You're asking us to consider the scope of his representation in these other matters that aren't on appeal before us in this case. So, for example, you cite cases like Kaiser I think it's Chersey, and you cite Jones in your brief. All of those cases are cases in which the representation that's looked at in determining whether a waiver was valid is from the same case. It's not from a separate file. And so I'm wondering, even if we were to accept for purposes of your argument that we could look at these other cases, do you have any authority indicating that we can go beyond just simply considering someone's experience with the criminal justice system generally to what happened, the scope of representation that occurred in other cases? Because none of the cases I just mentioned from your brief are like that. They're all cases in which the defendant was represented for a period of time and then discharged their lawyer, and then a waiver is found to be valid in that same case.
I don't have a case exactly on point that says that.
The other question I had for you is this Henderson v. Morgan case you cited on page 16 of your brief. It's a Supreme Court case. You describe it as finding the plea voluntary after the defendant spoke with his attorney, because it is appropriate to presume that in most cases, defense counsel routinely explain the nature of the offense in sufficient detail, and I'll leave out the rest. But in that case, didn't the Supreme Court actually affirm the finding that the plea was involuntary? The ultimate conclusion of that case is that the respondent did not receive adequate notice of the offense to which he pleaded guilty, so his plea was involuntary.
I hope that's not the case.
I was looking at it in preparing for the argument because I was trying to find if you'd cited any cases in which it was the same matter up on appeal and, you know, there was a prior representation that was used for the waiver, and it just struck me that it does not stand for the proposition that the plea was voluntary that you described in your brief. And I wondered if that might have just been a typo or if you misread it.
I am certainly going to look at that and we'll correct it if that's been correct. I would never inaccurately represent a case intentionally.
Oh, understood. Thank you.
So I'm trying to think of what I can say that might convince this court that Mr. Dixon knowingly and voluntarily and intelligently represented himself, other than the fact that he was asking to proceed pro se, he wanted to proceed pro se, and he did proceed pro se. If all you are looking at is this case and nothing else, then really you're starting at page 8 of the state's brief and going forward from there. And it's thin on what he actually said regarding a public defender appointment. He didn't want the public defender. He didn't ask for a public defender in this case. So I would ask this court still, though, to affirm the district court finding that Mr. Dixon, under the totality of the circumstances, which include all of his conduct, was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zettler. Is there anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you. Mr. Clippert, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll set the clock if you choose to use it.
I will hopefully just use 30 seconds of it. I think the issue about the trials on the that were up on appeal in Dixon 1, the timing there is important because Dixon had, on my case, had a bail hearing on March 23rd, 22. Then he had what's titled the first appearance on 4/22 of 23, and that or 22, and that's when he waived his right to an attorney. The trials occurred days later on the two fourth degree assault case that were the basis of the Dixon 1 appeal. And then back at the omnibus hearing, no one revisited the issue with Mr. Dixon saying, hey, those first two cases didn't go so well. Do you want to, you know, what are your thoughts on having a lawyer? It wouldn't have to be coercive. But so at the time of the waiver, Mr. Dixon had not gone to trial. So so I think that's an important issue of the timing of that waiver. So with that, I would just ask the court to reverse and remand for a new trial.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Appreciate your patience with us this morning and getting this argument going. The matter is now submitted. We'll issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, counsel. Have a good day.
Thanks.